Get Abstract keeps you updated with summaries of the best business books published worldwide. Books you absolutely need to know in a convenient, smart format. And now, Get Abstract presents The Real Warren Buffett, Managing Capital, Leading People, by investment manager James O'Laughlin. The book was published by Nicholas Breeley Publishing. In this abstract, you will learn Warren Buffett's distinctive way of thinking about management and investment, why he thinks this way, how he built his fortune, why he is a maverick, and how he has remained confident and consistent while betting and making billions of dollars. A sentence crafter happily at work, author James O'Laughlin imparts clarity with literacy. His book offers many examples of industrious research, averaging some 90 footnotes per chapter. He widely quotes Berkshire Hathaway Chairman and Vice Chairman Warren Buffett and Charles Munger. On the rare occasions when he doesn't find just the right quotes, he uses their favorite metaphors from sports and life. His writing is excellent and falls short only on prophecy and damnation. Buffett must pass Berkshire on to an heir, but the author gives short shrift to asking exactly who might follow him. O'Laughlin also carefully avoids explaining how this unknown magician might cope with Munger, who is too old to be an heir. O'Laughlin began the book before the 9/11 attacks created insurance chaos, but he covers their short-term impact. He suggests that chaos benefits Buffett, whose main float derives from super-catastrophic insurance and reinsurance. Although events have proceeded at a fast pace since this book came out, Get Abstract recommends it highly. Along with getting to know the real Buffett, you will learn a tidy amount about economics. And now the summary.
Short division. Warren Buffett divides business into four boxes. One box is filled with the things that cannot be known, that are also unimportant. One box is filled with the things that can be known, but are not worth knowing. The third box is filled with the things that are important but cannot be known. Warren Buffett disregards all three of those boxes and spends his time rummaging only in the fourth box, dealing with things which are important and knowable. This box, he believes, defines his margin of safety, his circle of competence, and the limitations of his strike zone. Within the fourth box, holding that which is known and that which matters, Buffett meets the expectations of his shareholders and partners and operates according to those truths he holds self-evident. One of the most important of those verities is that the market may be efficient in the long run, but it is not always efficient, and it cannot be relied upon to provide a stock price equal to any given company's intrinsic value. This represents an evolution in Buffett's thinking. It was not always thus. Early Buffett. Warren Buffett spent almost 20 years walking the path described by his first mentor, Ben Graham, author of The Intelligent Investor. Graham rated a stock's value in relation to the company's assets. He did not base his valuation on the company's ability to create and sustain value over time. Buffett has a knack for identifying companies that were undervalued according to Graham's formula. He called this cigar butt investing, saying, "A cigar butt found in the street that has only one puff left in it may not offer much of a smoke, but the bargain purchase will make that puff all profit." In an era during the 1950s and 60s, when many stocks were undervalued, cigar butt investing made Buffett a success. From 1956 to 1969, the value of the Buffett partnership grew at a compound annual rate of almost 30%. The Dow grew by 10%. By age 26, Buffett had assembled the three partnerships that would provide seed capital for his future projects. He decided to take the cash flow from Dempster Mills, a manufacturer he had acquired, and invest it in other companies on behalf of the partnership. In furtherance of this goal, in 1961, Buffett became chairman of the board at Dempster. But try as he might, he couldn't make Dempster Mills managers shut down their assembly lines to release capital for his investments. He sold his stake in Dempster and bought up the stock of Berkshire Hathaway, a textile manufacturer. By 1965, Buffett owned enough of Berkshire to take over its operations. Buffett had met his second mentor and continuing partner, the often abrasive Charles Munger, in 1959, and was already listening to him by the time the Berkshire deal was done. Meister Munger. By 1970, Buffett was ready to dissolve his partnerships and eliminate the pressure they created to exceed previous achievements over and over. He was ready to abide by Munger's frequently repeated lessons, which contradicted Graham's philosophies. Buffett, who calls Munger his West Coast philosopher and the abominable no man, says that although Munger lacks formal training in business or economics, he has a powerful intellect and an instinctive grasp of investing. Because of these qualities, Buffett ultimately took his advice. Dempster and Berkshire Hathaway were similar. They made products as cheaply as possible and sold them at competitive prices. To remain competitive, they consumed capital for new tooling, improved distribution, and expanded marketing. Instead of harvesting Berkshire's capital to invest in other businesses, Buffett became entangled in the textile business, where every brand's products shared the same relative low value. In that industry, getting investment capital was the only barrier to new competition. Buffett stayed in the business too long because of the same competitive hopes that entrap many managers. However, when he finally closed the Berkshire Mills, he told his stockholders he should have done so a decade earlier. The interaction between Munger and Buffett led to a revelation about the difference between being in business and instead managing capital. What matters when you manage capital is how investors are motivated to act, or to not act, in moments of strategic stillness. Munger warned against having a corporate mindset that serves the good of investors above and beyond the good of a corporation and its operations. Often this approach, prioritizing stockholder profit above a company's ongoing needs, is so entrenched in corporate life that a board of directors will sanction it as part of a strategic plan. Buffett came to hate strategic plans because they often block essential changes and they never call for strategic inaction. Buffett says that Berkshire Hathaway's greatest advantage today is that it doesn't operate with a strategic plan, except for waiting for the phone to ring with fresh opportunities. The aha moment. Back in the early days of Berkshire, Munger asked Buffett if he was keeping the mills open because of his ego. He asked if Buffett was holding on to them because one day they would become sufficiently profitable. Munger cautioned Buffett against trying to understand an unfamiliar industry without obtaining first-hand knowledge of it. In his ongoing search for answers, Munger inspired Buffett to construct mental models that outlined various scenarios based on his experiences and to refer to them with confidence. Munger convinced Buffett to examine his decision-making processes, and he taught Buffett to look at each situation backward, that is, to invert it. In other words, first think of the best way to ruin a company. Contrast your plans and practices with that, and you will see what not to do and what to do. Munger told Buffett that intelligence was not sufficient. He had to rely upon information and experience, not just on his intellect. In the face of this counsel, Buffett began a period of rigorous self-evaluation and mental discipline. As Munger showed Buffett examples of what he had done wrong and offered him alternative ways of thinking, Buffett realized that he could have been far more successful, even though he had made Dempster Mills and Berkshire Hathaway profitable. Eventually, the businesses were able to generate an average of 15% profit a year. Nevertheless, Buffett experienced an explosion of understanding. He knew what he was going to do. Buffett changed his entire approach to business, began to view its possibilities more widely, and started working primarily not as an entrepreneur, but as an allocator of capital. Ted Williams' eyes. Buffett likes baseball metaphors, and he learned a great one from baseball giant Ted Williams. Williams spoke of the fundamental benefit of subdividing the strike zone into the most productive cells and then swinging only at strikes that flew into the sweet spot, the fat pitches with the highest odds for an extra base hit. Buffett did not want to be a successful investor. He wanted to be in the investor's equivalent of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Buffett stopped looking for a fair business to buy at a good price and began investing in good businesses at fair prices. Under his leadership, Berkshire selected Coca-Cola, Gillette, the Buffalo Evening News, Executive Jet, Geico, Flight Safety, See's Candy, and International Dairy Queen because they all offered low costs, managerial excellence, and the assurance they could not be overcome by any important, unknowable event lurking at the margins of technology. Buffett did not invest in the technological revolution of the 1990s, specifically because it was beyond his circle of competence. Dot-coms, as it turns out, were unknowable, so he confidently stayed away. No harm, no foul. With each solid acquisition, Berkshire's bulletproof corporations grew armor plating. Pepsi might compete with Coca-Cola, but it could never muster the resources to displace Coke. Who would start a competing newspaper in Buffalo when Buffett was already buying ink there by the barrel? Buffett says, "Our job really is to focus on things we can know that make a difference. If something can't make a difference or we can't know about it, then we write it off. I look for what is permanent and what is not." For several years, observers hotly debated the wisdom of Buffett's move to merge with General Ray in 1998. General Ray promised a vast float. It also held about 20% of its assets, totaling $24 billion in equities. Berkshire held 80% of its $50 billion investment assets in equities. With the merger, Buffett reduced his exposure to risk-intensive equities by almost 20% without paying a dime in taxes. That was the good news. As the market tanked, Berkshire was flush. It purchased most or all of Jordan's Furniture, Mid-American Energy, Court Business Services, U.S. Liability with its two high-risk insurance adjuncts, Justin Industries, Benbridge Jewelers, Shaw Industries, Benjamin Moore Paint, Johns Manville, MyTech Incorporated, Extra Corporation, Garin, and Fruit of the Loom, all for a total of around $10 billion. This was the ultimate example of Buffett and Munger's embrace of volatility. Berkshire Hathaway stock lost half its value from June of 1998 to March of 2000. They could not have cared less. Catastrophe hits. On September 11, 2001, the world's major catastrophic insurance companies were confronted with a loss scenario no one had imagined, certainly not even Buffett, who owned several of the insurance and reinsurance carriers that had the greatest liability. He saw the unanticipated terrorist strikes as an opportunity for his catastrophic insurance operations. Few could withstand the blow Berkshire had endured. Now, Berkshire had proven itself to be the dominant, an indomitable insurance seller in a market where a huge tragedy had driven premiums justifiably sky high. In May of 2002, as the fretting reached a frenzy, Buffett invented the world's first negative interest loan vehicle. Berkshire had muscled through the crisis beyond anyone's expectations, except Buffett's and Munger's. Now, Buffett devised a negative coupon security to offer investors something new amid the credit crunch of the time. He raised $400 million. In return, investors got 3% a year and a warrant to buy Berkshire stock in 5 years at a 15% discount in the price of its shares at the time they bought the negative coupon. Buffett, or more likely Munger, named it a squares. The best part was that the squares investor paid Berkshire a 3.75% installment premium on the warrants each year. Berkshire fundamentals. Such activity would bedraggle other CEOs and frighten off ordinary shareholders. Not so at Berkshire. Buffett thinks that analysis based on comparing Berkshire stock prices a year ago at this time is meaningless. The company pays no dividends. It counts its benefits and incentives as actual costs. It keeps its annual report as simple as possible by refusing to use a marketing firm or spin doctors to communicate with investors or analysts. It refuses to split its stock. It does everything possible to make its investors comfortable and to deflect any investors who are not willing to stay with Berkshire over the long haul. Buffett has remarked often that a CEO should wonder what is wrong with his company and his management when investors constantly buy and sell his company's stock. Buffett sees his investors as partners and says he would be concerned if his partners wanted to sell their shares frequently. Does this defy every principle originally propounded by Graham, every corporate norm? Buffett answers, "I'd be a bum on the street with a tin cup if the market were efficient."
You've been listening to a business book summary from Get Abstract. To download the print version of this summary or other audio summaries, go to our website at getabstract.com. There you will find thousands of summaries of the best business books ever published. And thank you for listening to Get Abstract Book Summaries.